My name is John Kahini. Today is November 6th, 1979. And I am preparing this tape for the benefit of Dr. Peter C. Rollins, Associate Professor at Oklahoma State University, for his use in his project entitled Television's Vietnam. This tape will describe my involvement in the Battle of Khe Sanh, by way of background information, I was a first lieutenant with the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, during the siege of Khe Sanh. I had originally joined the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, in January of 1967, and I was with the battalion when it arrived at Khe Sanh in early May of 1967 to conduct the mopping up operations after the battles for Hills 881 South, 881 North, and 861. At that time, I was platoon commander in Alpha Company 126. However, in July of 1967, I was transferred to the Battalion Operations Center as the S3 liaison officer. I served with the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, up until July of 1968. During the entire time of the siege, however, I was assigned to the operations section as a liaison officer. I had a fortunate opportunity to come home on leave from Khe Sanh during the middle of the siege. I left Khe Sanh on February 15th for a 30-day leave in the United States as a result of my extending my tour with the battalion for 6 months. I returned to Khe Sanh on April 1st, 1968, in time to participate in Operation Pegasus, the operation by which the 26th Marine Regiment left the combat base and pushed the North Vietnamese units back into Laos. I've organized this tape into three basic areas. The first one is an area which I will discuss some of the myths I encountered during my leave in the United States. By this I mean certain beliefs which people that I encountered during my 30 days at home had concerning the battle at Khe Sanh. Most of these beliefs which they had were based on reports from the media, primarily television. I will then go into some additional experiences that I had during the siege at Khe Sanh, and finally make some comments on the position paper which was sent to me with the letter from Dr. Rollins on October 8, 1979. One of the first myths that I encountered when I arrived back in Long Island, in I guess it was probably the third week of February when I finally arrived, the first one was that the Marines at Khe Sanh were caught without any warning, or it was the opening of the siege was in somehow a surprise. This was obviously not true, as early as early December, the battalion became aware of increased North Vietnamese activity in the Khe Sanh Plateau. While it is true that for the 4 months preceding that, things were rather slow, when early December came, we were quite aware that things were heating up. In that light, slide number one is a picture which I took in early December of Andrew Sibley, the intelligence officer of the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, his Vietnamese interpreter, Sergeant Lung, and our artillery officer, Lieutenant Smith. They are at the Khe Sanh airstrip awaiting the arrival of a reconnaissance team which had engaged North Vietnamese units. Slide number two is a picture of some of the equipment that was captured being carried by the recon team. As a result of the buildup that we were aware of, the regimental headquarters brought up the 3rd Battalion, 26 Marines, to Quezon. 326 went on an operation west of Hill 881 South and 881 North, trying to locate some of the North Vietnamese units. I was privileged to go on that operation with them as a guide and to assist them in making their way through the heavy elephant grass and hilly areas west of 881 South. I had had extensive experience patrolling that area when I was a platoon commander with Alpha Company. Slide number 3 is a slide of myself on that operation, walking through the chest-high elephant grass. Slide number 4 is a picture of Major Caulfield, the operations officer for the 3rd Battalion, 26 Marines, whose accounts of the actual Battle of Quezon are quite well publicized. And with him is the executive officer of 326, Major Brown. It was clear after that operation was conducted that we knew that something was going to occur rather soon. However, my conversations with my friends and relatives when I was at home indicated that they hadn't been aware of it at all, which is true. The press very rarely came up to Quezon during those quiet times before the siege. Slide number 5 is another picture of myself, which was taken in the bunker which the company grade officers had at the battalion combat operations center at the base at Quezon. There were about 6 or 7 lieutenants and captains who stayed in this bunker. It was called the Womb. This particular photograph was taken on Christmas Eve, and it brings back that evening to me. I had stood the watch in the 126 command center that evening, and even though there was a truce on, the radio relay site on Hill 950 was attacked by a North Vietnamese unit. The relay site was protected by a platoon under the command of Lieutenant Wells of Charlie Company, and the attack was repulsed, although there were 5 Marines wounded in that incident. We knew that something else was amiss when on January 2nd we all received, or we all heard, the shots being fired on the perimeter by 326. That was the incident where the North Vietnamese officers were trying to recon our perimeter. I do remember specifically on that evening that myself and several of the other officers and some of the staff NCOs from 126 had gone over to one of the old Southeast Asian huts that was used as the enlisted club, and we were watching a Peter Sellers movie called After the Fox. I remember it quite well because we knew we were going to be hit fairly soon, and wherever we went, we always carried our helmets and our flak jackets. And we were in the club watching After the Fox, a Peter Sellers movie, wearing our flak jackets and our helmets, and drinking a very odd combination, but it was the only thing we had. It was some scotch, it was warm, we didn't have any ice, and Dr. Pepper. We all thought it was rather funny that it tasted so good, but I guess when you don't have very much, even things like scotch and Dr. Pepper taste pretty good. I make these comments mainly to indicate that the Marines at Quezon were well aware of the increasing enemy activity before the siege. However, it's my impression that the media, especially the television networks, gave the impression that we were ill-prepared for the siege, and we didn't really know that it was going to happen. That leads me into another point. A great deal has been said about there being no overhead cover at Quezon. There was overhead cover. There was sufficient overhead cover for the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, the regimental headquarters, some of the other units that were there, and for the 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines. However, what occurred was when the 2nd Battalion, 26th Marines arrived, and the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, and the Vietnamese Ranger Battalion, obviously they had to build their own shelters, and that did pose some some difficulty. However, the perimeter was intact, and everyone on the night of January 21st, 1968, the night that the siege actually began, had adequate cover. I think that is brought out by a fact that even though the ammunition dump was destroyed that evening, the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, which was holding the main perimeter, or I should say about half of the main perimeter, the eastern half, and had its entire battalion headquarters located basically in the V-ring, as we said, only had one individual killed that evening by the rocket attack that struck, and that was a radio operator who left his bunker to go outside to secure his radio after the attack had begun. Slide number 6 is a slide taken inside of the junior officer's bunker, which was affectionately entitled The Womb, just shortly after Christmas. And as you can tell from the inscription written on the parachute lining that was used for a wall, we had a rather strange sense of humor considering the fact that our mail hadn't arrived. We merely listed Santa Claus as a casualty. You can also see on the ceiling a slogan that was quite popular at the time. Slide number 7 is the sign that we had out in front of the junior officer's bunker there, referring to it as the womb. And slide number 8 gives an indication of what occurred on the evening of January 21st. Even your overhead cover wouldn't do you much good if it took a direct hit. The womb was virtually destroyed. However, we were all in our underground bunkers at the time that occurred. My duties at the time were to organize the alternate command post and to monitor the battalion nets at that position. So most of the officers from the battalion headquarters who lived in that blown-out bunker were either in the command post or in the alternate command post when that occurred. We also had several dime marker bunkers established before the siege started, but we didn't have them all, primarily because it was difficult to get the building materials in. The local wood that we tried to use for construction of various bunkers was of very poor quality. The montagnards would go out and cut it for us, but it was all diseased and rotten. The CBs were charged with keeping the runway open, also had a occasion to hoard pallets of plywood and other building materials, unfortunately. But the young Marines that I knew at the time were always very resourceful and always managed to get enough material for their overhead cover. Now, the fighting trenches did not have overhead cover on them, and there's an obvious tactical reason why they wouldn't. And a number of the press accounts indicating the lack of overhead cover talked about the trench lines. However, I know personally the Hill 881 South and 861 were quite well fortified, and the main base camp was also. The regimental command post was underground in an old French bunker. Our battalion command post was also underground in an old special forces bunker. On the evening of January 21st, the Air Force weather people vacated their die marker bunkers, two of them, which were then used as an additional medical facility by the regiment. One of the other interesting myths that I encountered when I got home, slide number 9 is also a picture of, it is a picture of the battalion command post of 1st Battalion, 26th Marines. And one of our young corporals is reinforcing it with a sandbag. You can tell kind of the disdain some of the troops had for danger. This young corporal is walking around without his helmet on and without his flak jacket. One of the other myths that I encountered when I got home was the so-called vermin syndrome, that rats were running all over the base. Slide 10 is a picture taken inside the wombs shortly before its destruction of our adjutant, Lieutenant Fitzgerald, with, of course, the standard rat trap in his hand. There's no doubt that there were rats at the base and that the trash dump outside the perimeter was swarming with rats. But the rat problem that was blown up by the press was one that was occurring in the North Vietnamese area. We didn't have any serious problem with rats because our field sanitation, even throughout the siege, was outstanding. Lieutenant Fitzgerald had an interesting experience in that regard, however. He had gotten a letter from a congressman or a congressman's aide asking that a letter written by a mother of one of the young Marines at Quezon to be the allegations in that letter be investigated. It seems she was under the impression that her son was eating rats. Well, the actual letter that the mother received from the son stated that the son was thrilled because he didn't have to eat sea rations anymore, because some of his buddies had gotten a hold of some long rats. Of course, he meant long-range patrol rations, the dehydrated type. His mother, however, after hearing the news about the rats running wild, thought he referred to a rather large vermin instead of long-range patrol rations. Another myth that I encountered was the Arvin can't fight myth. And one of the things that struck me as rather odd is that even though we had such great press coverage and TV coverage of the siege at Quezon, very few people realized that the Arvin Ranger Battalion was there with us. And those that realized that they were there had no idea how well they fought. Slide number 11 is a picture of a Arvin soldier on his way to the perimeter on the day that they arrived. They went and took over the eastern portion of the perimeter. Back of him is some of the destruction from the siege. That was what is left of the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines mess hall. I knew personally of one incident where the Arvin Rangers displayed tremendous courage. They, like the Marines, were under strict orders not to engage in any type of offensive actions. Daily, their perimeter would be hit with mortar fire and of course, rocket fire and artillery fire from the North Vietnamese. North Vietnamese got very clever. They brought up a Russian, I believe it was an 88-millimeter recoilless rifle, and placed it in a tree line about 500 meters from the Arvin's trench line. Whenever the Rangers would receive artillery and mortar fire, they would, of course, duck and get under cover. Then the North Vietnamese would take the 88-millimeter recoilless rifle and start pinging away at their bunkers, scoring, of course, direct hits. At 500 yards with a recoilless rifle, you can hardly miss. The Arvins asked for permission to go out and make an assault on the North Vietnamese gun position, and it was refused from Colonel Lowndes because he was under direction from Westmoreland, and I think even as high as President Johnson, not to engage in any offensive actions because we didn't have a reserve to bail us out if we got in trouble. Well, this went on for about another day, and finally a bunch of Arvins just on themselves went out there, sat in the trenches, waited for the mortar attack. As soon as it started to drop, they ran out, ran into the tree line, killed the crew, and captured the recoilless rifle and brought it back into the base camp. Another incident occurred when Sergeant Long, whose picture is in one of the photograph with Lieutenant Sibley, was he was on liberty in the village of Quezon on January 21st, and when the attack came, he was unable to get back to Quezon. He was wearing civilian clothes, and the North Vietnamese didn't pay much attention to him. He managed, however, to arm himself and fight his way through the North Vietnamese lines and get back into the base camp and spend the rest of the siege with the battalion. Another incident that didn't receive any coverage at all was the tremendous job a young sergeant, whose name I believe was Kelly, did with the platoon in the village of Quezon. Kelly was in charge of the CAC company down there, and he and his Marines and his Vietnamese Popular Force troopers did an incredible job of fighting their way back into Quezon once the town of Quezon had been overrun. Another misconception was that the Marines were afraid to attack the North Vietnamese or couldn't do it. Slide 12 is a photograph of Lieutenant Walt Chapman, the Commandant of the Marine Corps' son, who was at Quezon up until, I believe, around January 28th, at which time his tour was up. And it's interesting that about 2 days before he was going to leave, he was wounded by a piece of shrapnel, not seriously, but in a very embarrassing place. Lieutenant Chapman was the executive officer of Delta Company, and when the North Vietnamese overran the village of Quezon, Colonel Lowndes ordered Delta Company to proceed towards the village of Quezon and to open up the route for those refugees or the PF forces, or the CAP platoon, so that they could make it back to the base camp. Delta Company went all the way down the road, fighting its way, till they got on top of a hill whose number, I believe, was 472, although it's been a long time and I can't really recall, where they occupied that position and looked down basically into a regimental command post being established. They then decided that discretion was the better part of valor and turned around and made their way back to the main base camp after having completed their mission of opening up the road to enable the refugees to make it back. Another interesting story about the kind of courage the Marines had there was when the Special Forces camp at Lang Ve was overrun by the Russian PT-76 tanks. There was a great deal of apprehension as to whether or not the main base camp could withstand an attack by armored units. We had 5 tanks, 5 Antoses, a great number of recoilless rifles, and 3.5 rocket launchers. But we were afraid of an attack coming at night, and we needed a plan in case there was an armor penetration of the main base camp. And our battalion needed an anti-mech plan, an anti-mechanized attack plan. And I drafted it. And while I was drafting it, one of the radio operators in the command post came up to me and said that if the tanks broke all the way through into the perimeter, he had an ideal way of knocking them out. He was going to take the thermite grenades, which we had in the command post, which are grenades that are designed to destroy important documents and safes and radios. They'll burn through about 8 inches of steel. He was going to take the thermite grenades and a roll of masking tape and sneak up behind the Russian tanks and tape the grenade to the engine housing so it wouldn't roll off, and then pull the pin. I really don't know whether he was serious about it or not, but I really think that if he had to do it, he probably would have. Shortly after the siege began, there was a very interesting rescue of a jet helicopter pilot. This, again, was never reported, as far as I could tell. A A-4, Marine Corps A-4, was on a mission somewhere west of Khe Sanh when it was hit by any aircraft fire. Myself, Lieutenant Sibley, and our acting battalion surgeon, Dr. Ed Feldman, a Navy lieutenant, were standing out in front of the doorway to the 1st Battalion 26th Marines Combat Operations Center when we saw the plane get hit and saw the pilot punch out. His parachute started to come down over the base, but it looked like it was going to miss the base on the east side. And, of course, what that meant was he was going to end up in North Vietnamese hands. On the east side of the base, right out in front of the position, part of the perimeter where the Arvin Ranger Battalion linked up with Bravo Company, was a large grassy field. But on the other side of that was a tree line, and a few yards past that was a sheer cliff. It looked like he was going to go out over the cliff. Well, Andy Sibley and Ed Feldman and myself ran out and commandeered the ambulance, which had delivered the surgeon down to our area. We got in it, drove through the ammunition dump, and through the gate onto the airstrip, and all the way down the airstrip. And actually, it was kind of a funny scene because Andy had jumped in the driver's seat, and the doc had jumped in the back, and I went around to the shotgun side to get in. And of course, in those Marine Corps ambulances, you can't get into them on the shotgun side because the stretcher bars are there, and you can't sit in it. So I had to hang on to the outside. And of course, Andy wasn't paying much attention to where the duds were on the ground. He was just trying to get the ambulance down there to help pick up this pilot. But as we got onto the airstrip, it became rapidly apparent to him that he had to really be careful where he was driving because there was a great deal of shrapnel on the airstrip, and he could tear up the tires. So he was cutting back and forth and almost tipped over the ambulance a couple of times. Meanwhile, the Marines from Bravo Company had seen that this pilot was in peril and had started to climb through their own barbed wire. It took them quite a bit of time to do that. We then pulled the ambulance off the airstrip and started to drive across this big grassy field. At the same time, the Marines from Bravo Company opened fire on the tree line to suppress any North Vietnamese that might get the wrong idea in there. And we went over and picked up the pilot. Or I should say we went over and met the pilot and asked him if he wanted to ride back in. And he said, hell no, he was going to walk back in into the base, and which he did. We later saw him as he marched into the regimental command post to report to Colonel Lowndes. It quite an interesting scene to see the this pilot walk about a quarter mile through the open carrying his parachute. It took a lot of courage for him to refuse our ride back in. There's also a great deal said about the fact that the Marines' morale was very low during the siege. Of course, nobody there really enjoyed it. it wasn't a pleasant experience. However, there were a lot of signs apparent to anybody that the morale was excellent and that the Marines certainly weren't disenchanted. One of the things that bothered the Marines in Vietnam